Alors, nous accueillons la troisième conférence de Pavel Lourier. Alors, avec ces deux dernières conférences, nous passons du domaine de la documentation archéologique à celui de la documentation philologique. Mais le partage n'est en fait, comme vous allez le constater, pas si net, puisque l'archéologie de la Sogdiane, dans certains cas, éclaire notamment les faits vocabulaires l'archéologie sogdienne a considérablement évidemment bénéficié dans ses interprétations des matériaux notamment archivistiques qui ont été découverts en relation avec les deux sites que Pavel a déjà présentés, c'est-à-dire Penjikent et Madrushkat. Donc, je passe sans plus attendre la parole à Pavel.
Merci, Franz. Merci bien. In this paper, I'm going to speak about something like a rather unusual, I would say, matter about some trying to understand some linguistic features of Sogdian in the framework of its history, its archaeology, and so on. So I will be speaking not so much about text, but rather about some individual words, usually nouns, and try to find some references to it in various parts of history. So this is a kind of collection of essays, quite short ones, about some short etymological notes, which have some interest, maybe. Some of them are for sure, some others are hypothetic, some others are like variant possibilities of doing things, and so on. So in this work, usually the linguists work, the Iranian studies is very much related to the historical linguistics or comparative linguistics, so the history of languages and their comparison and joining to one another into genetic units and so on. And of course this Sogdian language is, here. It is one of Iranian languages. The Iranian language group is closely related to Indo-Aryan language group, and they all are part of Indo-European family, as all of you know, like other most languages of Europe, including French and some languages of Asia, and now also America and Australia and even Africa. One of the important features of these Indo-European languages of the historical linguistics, which is developed firstly for Indo-European languages, but also for many others, such as Finno-Ugric languages, for example, are the correspondences of one sound, one phonetic unit to another in the different languages, according to more or less well-established groups. So sometimes correspondences are quite obvious and sometimes not. So in the Indo-European bratr develops in Persian baradar, English brother, Slavonic brat, Latin frater, and so on. It is obvious. Sometimes it's not so obvious. So Indo-European word for wheel, kwekolo, something like this, would give in Persian charh, in Old Slavonic kolo, kukel, in Tocharian, oldest landing, huel, English wheel, and in Sanskrit, chakra. And chakra is probably the word which not only Sanskritists know today, because it came to European languages, and their first picture at Google Images which showed chakra was like this. So I think that most of you know that chakra is more a kind of units in the Asian Indian medicine, in the yoga and so on, which are concealed somehow in the person, and not many people know that it originally means wheel. So etymologically, English wheel and chakra are the same words, but we see that they are not developed completely differently into different languages, but they also have completely different meaning. And chakra is a loan word in English, meaning these points and so on. And in order to understand that, we have to, first of all, to dwell into Indian philology, philosophy, medicine, and so on, to understand that the wheel was a very important thing for the for the ancient Indo-Aryan peoples who were charioteers, and that this wheel was the idea of the world, of world turning around itself, and and macrocosmic idea of the wheel of the world was very common. And in yoga, this macrocosmic wheel, macrocosmic ideas turned into microcosm, into what is inside the person, and that's why finally in yoga we have these chakras, which are inside the skeleton of the human. But why did it enter Western languages? Because Western philosophy, Western medicine, until quasi-medicine, until late 19th century, didn't know any ideas about this chakras. So this concept was alien. And only by the end of 19th century, with the development of this interest into Eastern things, into Oriental mystics and so on, this term for chakra appeared in the Western languages. So this is a kind of a methodological thing to know, that we have to trace the why the term is borrowed and in which form, in which linguistic form, which is more or less regular. So the German scholars of the early 20th century developed the special field of study, which we called in German Wörter und Sachen, so the words and the things, the items, so which means that the change of meaning often corresponds to change of things, as Rudolf Meringer, the father of this idea, coined more than 100 years ago. And so in other, in our, during the next 50 minutes, we will speak about this some words combining with some realia. So in some cases, we need to analyze etymology of the words, so their phonetic features, and very important is analysis of loan words, time and direction of loan words, and of course, phonological analysis of context where these words are attested. And we compare it to realia, archaeological, historical, artistic, even zoological, and so on. Sometimes this method appears to be a kind of a charade game of understanding how the things are related to one another. So you are maybe puzzled with zoological things, and we will start with them. Just a good example, a classical Persian word sher, or modern shir, which means from one side lion and from other side tap of water. There is those who know Persian also know that there is another word shir, which means milk, but historically it's completely different. It doesn't have much hul a vowel, but long e. How could they combine to one another? Actually, the answer is in the history of the water supply in the world. The mouth or the head of the lion was usually a decorating of tap or a fountain in the west or sometimes in the east, like in central Turkey. That's why the lion becomes the tap for water. This is not really zoology, and as well as the next thing is not really the botanics. We know in the European word for ship, naus, or here I omit laryngeal things in respect of Indo-European linguistics, which are very important in phonological things, but not so important for us, and they are kind of not making things more clear, so we can avoid it and not write nehus with second h. So Indo-European naus, which is Latin navis, Gallic nausum, Old Indian nava, Persian nav, which means ship. And on the other hand, we have the word for gutter or canal or ravine, like nav, nova, and probably Avestan navia can also come here. How these two can be combined? How can we explain these two things? We have to look at the most old and most archaic model of a ship, or rather of a boat. Here it is from the Hermitage. So it is a trunk of a tree which is cut from inside and it turns into a boat. And this is the image of Nava, the photo of Nava, of Nav, I've taken in Yagnob, in the Zarafshan Mountains. And you see, so the idea is of something like aqueduct, to bring water above a gorge. And it is the same trunk. So the wooden trunk, hollow in the center, or half of the trunk, put like this. So in some cases it can be used as a boat, and in some cases with slight modifications it can be a gutter. Or another thing, turning back to zoology, is the mythical Kara fish. Kara in Avestan, in Pahlavi, Kar, the biggest fish, a guardian of sacred tree and mythological fish. And Sogdian, it's a kind of a great whale who swallows kind of Jonah in one of the Manichaean tales. Etymologically, this Kara, as it was shown by Pokorny and by Henning, comes from Indo-European squalos, like Latin squalus or German wels. All of them meet catfish. But why? Why could this catfish become the superfish? Because it is the superfish. So the catfish is one of the biggest fishes in the sweet water. This is the fish, the catfish, which was found, found in Sirdarya, in Yeksartes, in a few years ago in the Kazakh side, and it is bigger than a human. It's not digestible, this big catfish, because it's all made of fat now and nothing. There is even a bigger catfish, but it was found in Chernobyl, so it doesn't touch us here. So these giant catfishes, they are living in various rivers of Eurasia, and so the proverbial ones, the ones which are reported to eat humans, were in Volga River and in Amudarya River and in Sirdarya River. This map also shows that they exist in Sefid Rud, but I don't know to how big are they there. Not so big. So I think that if some member of a Western community would ever find a fish like that, he would immediately put it into his mythological framework as a kind of a superfish. So this could be a kind of indication that this Avestan community passed somehow through the valleys of Sirdarya and Amudarya. And from this big fish, we come to a very small insect, the ant. Ant has the similar words in Sogdian and in Horasmian, zmurak, zmurch, zmurik, which has its second part, so murak, murch, murik, has the good correspondences in Indo-European. It's Avestan Maori, Khotanese Munjaka, Middle Persian Mur, modern Tajik Murche, Murcha, Greek Myrmex, and so on, from Indo-European root. But here we have initial Z, which is very difficult to explain, and my proposition is to reconstruct it as a simplification of Zammarwi, earth ant, the ant of earth. But why? What has this ant to do with earth? And what appears, and what is very good known for everybody who digs the soil of Central Asia and probably in Iran? There are many ants there in the soil, but Unlike what we know from Europe, from moderate zone, where the ants build ant houses above the surface of the ground, nothing like that is found in Central Asia and probably also in Iran. So this is really the earth ant, an ant which doesn't build ant house above their ground level. So this could be a nomination which appeared when the progenitors of Sogdians and Horasmians entered their modern habitus from the northern zone, from a steppe zone. So I started already speaking about Sogdian language, and further I will speak more and more about Sogdian and some neighboring languages as well. So for some information, trivia about Sogdian, it's an Eastern Iranian language of the Middle Period, like Bactrian, Horasmian, Khotanese, Alanic. The main texts are dated to 4th to 10th century of Common Era and were found in Turfan and Dunhuang, the majority of texts, but not all of them. Very important, the texts were found elsewhere. And mostly they were found in early 20th century during the great exploration of that, that region. The language is written mostly in three varieties of Western Semitic alphabet, the Sogdian script, or national script. I will speak about it more in detail in our forthcoming lecture, in Manichaean script and in Christian Syriac script, another variation very similar to Estrangela. But there is also a number of secular documents or texts referring to the, well, what's difficult to... Some people call it Mazdaism, so Sogdian variation of Zoroastrianism or ancestral religion of Sogdians, which has very close ties to Zoroastrianism. I don't want to dwell in these matters today. So Sogdian language died out in the Middle Ages, but in the mountains of Tajikistan, modern Yugnobi language is continuation of a dialect close to Sogdian. So it is not continuation of the written Sogdian language. It's a different, its origins are somewhat different. So they're not relations of mother and daughter, but the relation of aunt and of a cousin. And in Sogdians who were so active in trade and in intercourse with various peoples around had a great number of connections of their language. So the linguistic connection, the loan words in first instance, are mirroring their real relations. And this is, of course, not the complete picture. So I avoid here, for example, Tokarian loans from Sogdian, which are quite well attested, and some others. And here, this map shows the relation of some words which I am going to speak about. So Sogdian is in the center. Then are several Iranian languages. These are the donor languages for Sogdian, and these are recipient. And these are the languages surrounding Sogdiana, according actually to what was defined as worldview of Sogdians by Franz Grenet. So to the north there are Turks, to the south there are Indians, to the west there are sometimes Persians, sometimes Byzantines, and to the east there are Chinese. This great amount of loan words in Sogdian is in sharp contrast with what we see in Yagnobi language, so the continuation of a dialect close to Sogdian. Only three words could I find among the whole vocabulary of Yagnobi which has pre-Islamic loans. So there is a plenty of Arabic words, of course. There is a great number, unlimited number of Tajik words in Yagnobi language. There is a serious group of Turkic loans. Not of all of them are very recent, and some are quite archaic and interesting. But only three of them are from pre-Islamic times. Some of them are disputable, like what is the origin of Sogdian Ark and Middle Persian Harg work, and Karach is a difficult word, and so on. So unlike Laulan Sogdians, the ancestors of Yagnobis did not probably contact with others. So they were living in their valleys, in their mountains, and had very little contact to any other people. That's the reason for this humble number of loan words in Yagnobe. And now I think that say something completely opposite to what is usually said by the purists who exist, I think, in all language communities of the world, who try to clean their languages from their foreign loans to make it pure without any loans and so on. From this table, we understand that the number of loan words indicates the richness of the culture. If there are less loan words, the culture is not so rich. In the case of Yagnobe and Sogdian, that is quite obvious. And now let's turn to some of the words. Some of the small things have been published, some are not, some are for sure, some are dubious. But here there will be the loan words and the ideas to date them and to understand them. So let's start with Greek words in Sogdian, and I took only three ones of them which are important for one study. Two of them are the names of coins or measure of weight in Sogdian. One is ester, from Greek stater, tetradrachma, and another is drachm, from Greek drachme. Another thing which have to put into this consideration concerning drachm is gemat, the name of goddess in Sogdiana, which was explained by Nicholas Sims Williams first as Greek Demeter. Here we see the development that Demeter turned into Dremet, the form Dremat, the form we know in Bactrian language, and then this initial Dr changed into J, which is the normal development, the standard development in Sogdian. But we do not see it with Greek drachme. So here, dr continues in Sogdian and doesn't turn into z. I was puzzled with this for a while, and then I realized that drachm came into Sogdian language later, after this shift of dr into z ceased and did not exist anymore. And indeed, the word ster is attested in ancient letters, first of all, very many times, but drachm doesn't appear before 7th century. I think the first attestation is the contract of the female slave from Kocho and in Mount Mook documents, quite of course. So it appears only in the 7th century. My idea, consequently, is that ster, it borrows from Greek stater, but directly. But drachm is not borrowed directly from Greek, but from Middle Persian, from Sasanian drachm, which makes a very good sense because this ster would mean a coin of Hellenistic type. The Hellenic coins came into Asia with Alexander and continued to be minted and then to be imitated until 7th century, effectively until 4th century. So this is a good variety of Antioch coin from Samarkand, from early Samarkand. And this drachm is Middle Persian drachm, the Sasanian drachma, the main currency which became very widespread and very much imitated in Middle Asia, but at a later period, so for imitation we can say about 5th and 6th century. I didn't have a chance now to look to the Silog with about coins found in Uzbekistan and Tajikistan to understand when what are actually the first numerous drachm to be Sasanian drachms to be found in Sogdiana and around it. So this is ster, this is drachm, and this is, by the way, gemat, the Demetra in the painting with lamentation from Panjikent. It was recently restored in the Hermitage. Another group of loan words also related with some surety to coinage are some loan names, personal names which are loaned in Sogdian from the dialects related to Sisian, Sarmatian, and Saka peoples. So this is the list of some of the better names which might be explained with more or less surety as loans or something related to Sisian, Sarmatian, Indo-Saka things, like the words containing Ossetic Ardar, military chief, or parallel to Ossetic Exardag, the hero of Nautic epics, Azes. And some of them, the one in bold, are the names of this type which appear quite commonly on as the names of rulers. Chirth Sawan is the ruler of Samarkand in 311 in the ancient letters. Dach is also Dachch, appears on one of the on one of the inscriptions on civil vessels at the king. Mavak, Vanvan, and Hirkodes are the names we know from the coins. So it looks like that these names were at one point the names typical for the nobility, for the upper class of Sogdiana, who indeed were the representatives of some steppe Iranian people. So we have images of them. So of three of these kings with somewhat Sisian names. So Hirkodes, Mavak, and Vanvan. And we see here that their faces are also look not like Sogdians, but rather like these nomadic peoples with a ribbon in their head and with the protruding head with cranial deformation, which was typical for these nomads, and so on. So I think that these names are one of the indications of the ethnic origin of the rulers of Sogdiana before more or less classical period, before 7th century. But of course, many of these names continued to live later. That's about Sisian-Sarmatian. I'm jumping from one item to another, from one language to another, and the next thing is the Sogdian deity Vreshman. Vreshman is a Sogdian form of, usually it's considered to be the Sogdian form of Buddhist Vaishravana, the guardian of the Norse. This Sogdian form, Vreshman, has similarities in Khotanese Vreshmam, Bactrian Vresomano, Hebrew Sanskrit Vaishramana and not Vaishravana, but its phonetic shape is unusual. So the change of R from the end to the beginning and the change of of V into M is quite unusual. It is a Buddhist figure, so it is an Indian deity in Hinduism. It is often an epithet of Kubera, and in Buddhism, it's guardian of the nose, the head of the Lokapalas of gardens of the sides of the universe. And he was usually represented as armored gentleman above a dwarf. He was always in armor. The recent Buddhist encyclopedic Buddhist dictionary claims that origin of Vaishravana cult might be in Khotan, where this image was found. And thanks to the article of Franz Grenet of almost 20 years old, Vaishravana and Sogdiana, we know that this Vreshman also stepped outside Buddhist context in Sogdian art. So he was an armored god standing on a dwarf, which was found on several wall paintings in Panjagyan. He was usually next to Nanaya. Another indication came more recently from the sarcophagus of Virkak, of the Sogdian noble in Xi'an. And he is very detailed, in the very detailed epitaph, the names of his family are named, and none of them had Buddhist connotations. So one of them was Rshtat Vande, slave of truth, Vanuk, victorious one, Virkak, small wolf, wolfella, yeah, Ushi, Aurora, etymologically the same word, the down, slave of Demeter, Zhemat Vande, as we told, and this Vreshman Vande. So also the text doesn't have any Buddhist connotations, but Vreshman is translated in Chinese as Pisha, so also the name of Vaishravana. What made me curious about that was a reading of, recent rereading of Zoroastrian items from Armenia in the book of Mikhail Shenkar, where I realized the reference, completely forgotten by me, about Barshamin, one of the goddess who existed in Armenia. So Astlik is the goddess of Armenian provenance. This Barshamin is kind of Syrian, and all the other are Iranian gods, Zoroastrian gods. And it was clear that Barshamin comes from Aramaic Baal Shamin, Lord of Heaven. He was the deity of initially Phoenician peoples, but later was widespread in Palmyra, for example, and in Hatra. This Barshamin, of course, looks very similar to our Vreshman, especially taking into account that Western Iranian B corresponds to V in Sogdian. And in this Armenian Barshamin, this R on the place of Semitic L indicates that this word was borrowed via an Iranian language. So there could be a possibility that Sogdian Vreshman and Khotanese Vreshomano as well could be a kind of contamination of Vaishravana and Iranian god Barshamin of Semitic origin. But it is all quite unsure, so this is a possibility which I would like to investigate more and take into account, but I cannot believe in it completely because the other parallels between Baal Shamin and Vreshman, well, they exist. When you take two gods so slightly known to us, you will find some parallels between them. It's quite clear. So Baal Shamin marries Nanaya, for example, in the in one of the demotic texts from Egypt, and our Vreshman stands next to Nanaya in Sogdian paintings. But I think that they're quite few, and it is just a similarity of names. So maybe for Sogdian Vreshman, we don't need to take into account Baal Shamin and Armenian Bar Shamin. So as I said to you, many things I'm speaking about are controversial, disputable, and so on. This is the case. Another deity which was found in Sogdiana in unusual contexts is Mahakar, who is explained as a restful, as Mahakala in India. So one of them is the text P3, the magical text, which was recently translated by Franz Grenet and Samra Zarnouch. So in this text, which does not have necessarily Buddhist connotations, the oath with Mahakala is mentioned. So it is a kind of a deity outside Buddhist context. More interesting is the Christian Sogdian text of Passion of Saint George. Usually these Christian texts do not have any indications of local religion, but here it is. So on the place where George had to destroy the idol of Apollo in Greek and in Syriac version, he is destroying the idol of Mahakar. And then the sound comes from the Mahakar, and the demon is running from this figure. So it means that Mahakar was a kind of a deity known outside Buddhist context. It's probably not nothing, not very positive and not very nice, as we know from we see from the George's Passion. And of course, it was known for long that this Mahakar is a Sogdian rendering of a Buddhist name of Indian deity Mahakala. Mahakala is appears in Indian contexts and in Buddhist contexts, means great blue black or great time, and was a dancing, restful deity with dark body, and it was very prominent in Tibetan Buddhism. So these images are Tibetan and in Sogdian. In Sogdiana, we have the images of this, of the restful Shiva, of dancing Shiva, Shiva Nataraja. So this is one of the paintings preserved in the Hermitage. So here with the Shiva with blue body and with a trident under his hand dancing. He has actually three heads, and it is in the Hermitage. And this picture I know only from publications. It's one of the early finds in Hermitage. Here also Sogdians in Sogdian dresses, like here the gentlemen are in Sogdian dresses, are offering something to this blue-bodied dancing deity similar to Shiva. And another item is now in the Museum of Antiquities in Dushanbe, with the same blue bodied dancer with ugly face. So I think that the comparison of these attestations of Mahakala and attestations of this these deities in Sogdiana make it clear that this deity, this negative feature of Shiva, was called Mahakar, which has, by the way, some alliteration to the name of positive Shiva, which is in Sogdian Veshparkar, which was explained by Helmut Humber many years ago. And so this was about the loans to Sogdian from other languages. And now several examples of how Sogdian words unusually entered the languages of their neighbors. So one of them is the word for beads in the Pamir. It is in Ishkashimi Mishti Khobar, it's Hindu Kush language, Dardic language. Mishti, Vahi, Dharmishti, small beads. There is Persian Dur, the pearl, and so on. And this Mishti doesn't have etymology on the soil of Pamir and Hindu Kush. And so I propose that this Mishti comes from Sogdian Mushti, Mujeti, pearls, beads, seeds, or seals, or gemstones from Old Iranian Mudra, Middle Persian Muhr, and so on. The word Muj, or Muje, is well attested in Sogdian language. How could it happen? So we know much about Sogdians trading in these regions, in the Hindu Kush, in Pamir, in Karakorum, in medieval times, and they were passing by. There are records of how the king of Shugnan captured precious silks from Sogdian merchants and kept it in his treasury. And even in ethnographic times, the anthropologists recorded that the people there in that region don't really trust money and don't believe in money and don't use money or coins. That is true. So returning to our previous lecture, there was only 2-4 coins found altogether at Hisarak in the mountains. And sometimes bargaining about money with people in the mountains is something very strange, because the idea of money is very different from others. But they like beads very much. So these are the images of Ishikashimi and Shugni, gentlemen and lady, and you see that here and here on the neck they have some beads attached. So Sogdians could travel there, make trade. We know that they travel there and exchange with beads. And so that's the typical feature with which is well known from the colonial times in the New World and so on. And they exchanged something for beads, and that's why the beads are, the word for beads from Sogdian was borrowed in this territory. I forgot to say that the burials in Pamir also indicate the presence of imported beads for a large amount, even older than the climax of Sogdian trade. Another word which I propose to understand as terracotta figurine and then statue and so on is again attested in the P3 text kept in Bibliothèque Nationale and edited for the last time by Franz René and Samra Hazarnoush. So in the preparation of making reins, the magician had to make this cup Badizak, which is translated now as couvercle avec un bloc de sandal. This is a possible explanation, but in Old Turkic we have the word bediz, bediz, which means a statue or sometimes a balbal, sometimes a small figurine, sometimes an image, and so on. It is attested several times in Old Turkic texts, beginning with runic texts. It is theoretically possible that the Turkic word entered Sogdian at the time of P3. But I think that Iranian etymology of this item is more or less clear. It comes from old Iranian root abi dies. Abi is proverb, and dies means to press, to form, to make something, to make impression, to impress something. So it is the way how the Sogdians produced terracotta terracotta images with one mouth, just impression of matrix on their clay. This is not very typical Sogdian terracotta, but one of the most beautiful ones. And so initially that would mean this impressed terracotta, but then it could generalize into a more widespread concept of a figurine or of a statue. It's important that according to archaeological data, the main production of terracotta was already gone by 7th century. So the heap, the most part of them belonged to 5th to 6th century. This is how Sogdian word entered Turkic. And there is a great number of Sogdian words in Persian. Now this number has to be diminished seriously because many of them appear to be not Sogdian loan words, but Bactrian loan words. But one of them, I think, is still Sogdian, and even if it is Bactrian, it's worth interest. It's the word varg or barg, like, which means dam. It is attested in classical texts in Rudaki, Ferrohi, Attar, and other poets. It's very often attested in the medieval dictionaries, and today it is used in the territory of Central Asia and of Afghanistan. I don't know if this word exists today in present-day Iran. It is attested in toponymy of Sogdiana, where varg means dam. Most famous is Varakhsar, the head of the dam near upstream of Samarkand. And there is the ruler Vrakhchikhuvu, the lord of Varakh, in Mount Mook documents. I propose to derive this word Varakh from old Iranian Bagra, the dividing one, from the root bag. Phonetically, everything is fine. In Sogdian, initial B turns into V, GR turns into GR, and then there is metatesic to RG. So Varakh is a direct continuation of Bagra. But what's for the meaning? And here we have also to look at the concept of dam. What was it doing at that time? It was separating waters. The waters from the main course are separated from the waters which go into the canal. And Persian geography of Hudud-ul Alam of 10th century states that Varakhsar, so the head of the dam, is above Samarkand, is the place for distribution of waters of Samarkand. Khismatgahi Ab. And indeed, there at Varakhsar, present-day Ravoti Khoja, the main canals of Samarkand oasis, Bulungur and Dargham separate from Zarafshan itself. This is the photo of Varakhsar in 1930s in the museum located at Ravoti Khoja. And we spoke about Sogdian language as a recipient of some words, as donor of some words, but in many cases Sogdian was a transmitter, so located on the trade routes and interrelated with many cultures around it. It was one of the actors to produce an item from one cultural milieu to another. So even Sogdian language itself played the same role. So it was the mediator how the Aramaic script turned to become Turkic Uyghur script, and then Mongol script, and then Manchu script. And as Mongol script, it is still used today in Inner Mongolia, in China. And there are some words which indicates Sogdian as this important transmitter. One of them, the origin is in Chinese, it's te or chai. I'm sorry for my Chinese pronunciation. Ancient is tsek, writing table, register, document, which was borrowed into Sogdian chak, Horasmian chek, Bactrian tsak, and later it came to Persian chek, Arabic shak, French chek, and so on. So this means this document receipt and so on. And without Sogdian mediation, we wouldn't have checks. Yeah? Another word, the initial idea was by David Neil Mackens, and then Franz Grenet, Etienne de Lavoisier discovered Sogdian word, and Nicholas Sims Williams, the Bactrian word. Another word also has a very long history with Sogdian intermediation, and we have to look to the north of China, to the territory of Xunnu in the Han times. According to Han Shu, ceremonial sword of Xunnu was called like Jinglu, which is in early Chinese reconstructed pronunciation Kangra. It is one of the main indications that Xunnu language was related to Turkic, because in Turkey there is kırgırak, carved knife, still used today in Kyrgyz language, for example. But it was also probably borrowed in Sogdian, Khangar, Khagar, Horasmian, Khagar, Bactrian, Khangar, in modern Pamirian Hindu Kush words, Khugor, Khingar, and so on. It is Parthian Khanjir, Persian and Arabic Khanjar, Tatar Khanjir, Russian Kinjal, a very widespread word, and in some English dictionaries I found Dejer named as Khanjar. So this is the word which is probably comes to our days from the language of the Xunnu. And what is lacking here is the history of concept. So what was this sword, or maybe a one-sided sword, maybe dagger, which was so important among Xunnu that it was later borrowed into many languages of the peoples who were subject to Xunnu, to Huns, in later periods. One of these words where the Sogdian mediation is, or Horasmian mediation is also attested, is found in Russian rather archaic word busurman or busurmanin, which means now it is a kind of outdated non-believer, foreigner, or pagan. So in the first half of 19th century, it had a very specific meaning. So the army of Napoleon was called busurmani. And it is, of course, means initially Muslim. So Russian busurmanin comes from Turkic, musurman, busurman, besurmen in various languages, which means Muslim. This change of initial M into B is quite typical in Turkic languages of together, but not the case with R. We cannot find an example how a foreign L would turn internally into R in Turkic. And here the languages like Horasmian and Sogdian can help, because there the phonetic value of L was very low, and in many loan words this L was replaced with R, sometimes the. And indeed in Horasmian we have the form musurman. It is attested. So we could speculate that Persian word, that Persian musulman turned into Horasmian musurman and then into Turkic busurman. But the earliest attestations in Turkic, namely in the Christian epitaphs from Semiratia, there also with negative connotations, busurman indicate that it should come from Sogdian, because we cannot suppose the direct link between Horasmians and the Semiratia where these words were found. So in any case, Sogdian or Horasmian mediation is here necessary. And we are finishing the last word and the final brick in the wall. Also a word which is very well known in Russian, it is kirpich, which means brick. For a long time it was believed, and it is true, that it comes into Russian from Turkic languages. So in Mahmud Kashgari in 11th century it's kirpich, in Karakalpak today, for example, gerbish, in Azerbaijani kirpich, and so on. And recently Christiana Rek attested this word in Buddhist Sogdian in very clear context of a brick, which is like this, kirpich. And Christiana also explained it's as Sogdian loan words into Turkic. It doesn't have Turkic or Altaic etymology, by the way. And in Sogdian, it is the derivative with suffix ich, very widespread in Sogdian, from what is karp in Old Iranian Western karp, karp, which means form. But importantly, this is not the direct derivation of Old Iranian into Sogdian, where one would expect something like kshpich, kishpich, or kirpich, but from Western Iranian, such as Middle Persian kirb. And according to her idea, it is the one made in the form. And how could it be? What are realia behind this word? So this is the designation of, initially it was designation of sun-dried brick formed in rectangular molds, like today. And unlike hand-formed oblong bricks or globs, I don't know how you say it In French or in English, in Russian, булковидные кирпичи, which were not shaped in the rectangular, not in the mold. And these are used in Fergana today. These sun-dried bricks formed in the rectangular mold were entered into Sogdiana, first for fortification reasons, but then for others, from Western Iran in Achaemenid period, maybe at a later stage. So the excavations of Afrasiab are crucial in that respect. And since then, we're well incorporated in the Sogdian culture. So if it doesn't even calculate these sun-dried bricks as archaeological find. They are so numerous and so typical. They, of course, they are very good identification for the date and location. So in various places and at various times, the size of the brick was different. But this molded rectangular or square brick is common elsewhere. The nomadic Turks could borrow it somewhat later. I know information about Semirechye, the development of construction motifs in Semirechye and Khakassia, but probably in Turfan there could be some similar developments. I haven't looked it through. And later they produced to start baked bricks in Islamic times, which became quite common for monumental buildings in Islamic times. And is a baked brick, it entered into Rus with the Golden Horde. So Russians knew it even earlier, but it was of different size, the Greek plinth. So this is how this brick turned around. So once again, so this is unformed brick from Kirktepe. I think I'm sorry for the quality of photo. This is the Guvalak, so this globes of the earth from fountain Fergana today. Quite easy way of building. And this is the fortification of Afrasiab, with made of the formed brick. And this is how we made the bricks of Sogdian size for restoration purposes in Panjikent several years ago. I would say it's quite a hard work, and it's much easier to speak about bricks than to make them. Thank you very much for your attention.